Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. I am your host, Aaron Erber. This is a podcast about stories, myths, and the Catholic faith. Hey everybody, welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. Today I have longtime listener, I think, and first time guest, Matthew Scarence. He and I are our Twitter friends, and we are in the same Gene Wolfe appreciation group on Twitter. It's been a little slow. I haven't been reading much Gene Wolfe lately, but that's kind of how we met. You actually started the group and kind of got a bunch of us kind of weird Catholic people together and to talk about Gene Wolfe, which is cool. So you have like Mark Aramini in there and other people too. How about you introduce yourself, give us some background about yourself, your blog, just anything you want.
Yeah. So yeah, I started the Gene Wolfe kind of group to get people together, slowly growing. I am a freelance editor and writer from New Jersey, northern New Jersey, in the rural areas, not in the cities. And I graduated from Christendom College with a degree in history. Before I even started going to Christendom, I started a website called The War for Christendom, which no relation to the college, but that was supposed to host a group of articles and various essays, things about this book series that I'm writing about the return of the Holy Roman Emperors. And it grew into this general repository for historical and political essays that I've been writing. My main interests in history are the history of the European Christendom, the political aspects, the political philosophy of the Middle Ages. And this website just kind of became a repository for my work, in addition to the book series, which I'm still working on, have been working on for quite a while.
Nice.
It's not going to be published anytime soon. But yeah, that's kind of my background. So
cool. And today we'll be discussing one of the essays you wrote. I think you wrote it for college, I believe. But it's
that's correct.
An essay on Tolkien and the Carolingian dynasty. And how, why don't you go ahead and explain that essay? And it's kind of based on a couple different things. Tolkien's poem about St. Brendan, and the St. Brendan story that factors in, and then King Charlemagne or Emperor Charlemagne. Why don't you go ahead and kind of explain the basic thesis of your essay?
Yeah. So I wrote this essay for a class I was taking, on the Inklings. A class where we had the option to write on Tolkien or Lewis or any of the other Inklings. And what really stood out to me at that time was this element of the West in Tolkien's writings. Like, he focuses heavily on this idea of this geographical, almost sacred direction. And that really blossomed out of my interest. At the time, it was my senior year, I was writing my thesis on the Abendlands movement in Germany, the movement of Catholic intellectuals, academics, and politicians who were focused on this idea of the regeneration and the restoration of the West. And there were similar movements all throughout Catholic Europe, Belgium, France, Spain. And it stood out to me, this idea that Tolkien was actually working within the same tradition as these other writers, as these politicians, as these philosophers. Some names include, like, Dietrich von Hildebrandt, Romano Guardini, and these, in England also, Christopher Dawson, the historian.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Big influence on Tolkien. My professor for that class, actually, Dr. Adam Schwartz, really drew out those connections. And for this essay, I kind of wanted to examine three aspects of Tolkien's writing. The aspect of kingship, of Charlemagne's role as a model, but also his own ideas of what makes a good king, founded on the work and the political philosophy of St. Augustine and the City of God. I also wanted to look at the West as it was in the literature of the time, so the literature of the 9th century. So you have the Navigatio Sancti Brendani, which is the history, the monastic history, the monastic legend about this Irish monk, St. Brendan, the navigator, and how both of those played into the current focus of Tolkien's writings, the current day events that he was in some sense responding to when he was writing the novel.
Excellent. So with St. Brendan, for those who aren't familiar with the story, basically he's this Irish monastic, and he and a bunch of other monks, the numbers kind of vary on the story, but you know, it's usually, I think common telling is like 12 or something, yeah, like 12. That. Yeah. But sometimes it's like 40, you know, but they get on a boat, you know, and they set sail, and they want to look for, basically this blessed realm, this island of the blessed, you know, in the West. And they have a series of adventures, you know, and, Tolkien, pulls on this in his poem. But before we get to that, so this type of story is called an Imram. What is an Imram, and how does that factor into, Tolkien's work?
Yeah. So the Imram, or the Irish plural, I think is Imramana. I'm not an expert in Irish.
I'm Irish and I don't know anything about it. So yeah.
But it is a voyage story, but it's a specifically voyage story of the saints, because in the context of Ireland in the early Middle Ages, from about the 5th to the 9th century, you have all of these monastics who are founding communities on islands, who are founding communities on the coasts, and they are traveling from one monastic community to the other, bringing the Gospels, bringing stories, bringing the faith. And the Imram are these retellings of their journeys with these fantastical kind of elements, which really draw out the wonder and the adventuring spirit of these missionaries, where they're exploring God's creation to find the utmost reaches of the earth to bring the holy faith there. And there are these very popular, very elaborate stories. And the most famous of these is the St. Brendan story, but there are many, many others. So it's part of a long tradition.
And it's not just a Christian one, too. It's a one that comes from pre-Christian Europe.
There's a pre-Christian element in this journey narrative journeys to the other world, beyond the realm of the mortal, almost to the theme that comes up a lot in Tolkien's academic writings on the subject, the journey to the realm of fairy.
Right. I mean, you kind of see that, I don't know if it's connected to like the Odyssey, where Odysseus is on the island with, I think, Calypso, and he can have immortality there, you know, but he doesn't want it. And, you know, I think one of the essays you cite from, by Norman Roach, I think, and I could put a link in the show notes, but an example would be like a beautiful woman, like an immortal woman comes and whisks you off, you know, or like a god, like a small g god will come and he needs a mortal warrior, kind of like Odin, you know, doing that.
Very much tied to the theme of escape that Tolkien talks about in On Fairy Stories, where you're leaving the mortal world behind, you're traveling to the immortal realm, the realm that's not quite right for humans, but it's everything we desire.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think one example in her story, or her essay, was, this beautiful kind of goddess comes and takes this guy away, or like you brings this guy and his crew to the island, and then they're there for what they think is a year, but they've been actually gone for 100 or so years, which is very much in keeping with fairy lore. And then they return back to Earth, you know, to the human world, and they step foot on land and they turn into dust because it's been all the age kind of catches up to them at that moment. Tolkien is pulling from this sort of tradition this storytelling tradition that's like at the pinnacle of which is St. Brendan the Navigator story. And you kindly gave me some examples of that. And Andrew Lang has in his book of Saints and Heroes, he's got a good retelling of that story.
I can go into the Lang Tolkien connection if you want.
Sure. Yeah. Go for it. Please do. Yeah.
So Tolkien was a big reader of Andrew Lang, really Andrew and Leonora Lang, husband and wife, wrote these fairy books, the so-called rainbow fairy books, a series of books with different color names, so like the red fairy book, the blue fairy book, that were very popular collections of fairy tales for both children and adults through the period when Tolkien was growing up in the late 19th, early 20th century. And one of these books that's kind of adjacent, really kind of a companion piece to that series, is the Book of Saints and Heroes, which is this wonderful collection of various hagiographies, lives of the saints, golden legend stuff that they compiled, and contains a very good, concise, somewhat abridged retelling of the St. Brendan narrative. And we don't know that Tolkien read the other books. We don't know that he read this particular book, but I think it's extremely plausible that this is his first encounter with the story, that he's drawn through these explorations of fairies and heroes and just kind of the literature of the past to this very resonant image with him, because the image of the voyage repeats all throughout his work, both Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion.
Yeah, so how does he incorporate this story, this storytelling device? I mean, you have the concept of the West, and Imram in that same essay, it can be translated as like roving about, you know, like the it's like a roving kind of story. So how does he take that concept and put it into his legendarium?
Yeah, so the most explicit way that it enters the legendarium is through the Song of Eärendil and the various stories of Eärendil and the coming to Valinor of the elves. So you have of the messenger of men and elves, you have this voyager who is on a holy purpose, going through perilous seas, constantly facing challenges of mysterious islands and veils and clouds and things that he has to overcome, till he finally reaches this perfect paradise, this island in the West, where dwell the race of other beings. In the original story, it's a kind of group of fallen angels, but not devils. They're the classic, I guess, neutral parties in the war in heaven who get banished because they didn't take a side. But in Tolkien's work, this becomes the elves. This becomes a third Indrid that reflect the beauty and nobility of the highest achievements of art and the perfection of art and nature. And so you have Eärendil, this half-man, half-elf messenger, this divinely appointed messenger who comes to the West, sees the Isle of the Blessed, but he can't stay there. He's, like St. Brendan, he has to leave and continue upon his mission. And this idea of the West as this existent, this straight road to a paradise such as no longer physically a part of this world actually shows up in his retelling of the St. Brendan narrative, the death of St. Brendan or the Imran home, which he's creating this synthesis where he incorporates into the legendarium all of these mythical traditions of Christendom, for lack of a better term, because they're not strictly mythical. St. Brendan was a real man, he really lived.
Right.
But the legendary aspects of his life are incorporated into Tolkien's legendarium this way. They're connected to Valinor and to Elvenhome.
Yeah, and so in that poem, does he's incorporating the kind of the St. Brendan story into his Middle-earth legendarium, is that right? Yeah.
That's right. And he does the same thing, actually, or he was going to do the same thing when he finished his poem, The Fall of Arthur. He was going to bring Arthur and Lancelot, Avalon, into that
Wow. That would have been crazy. yeah, so I didn't when I read the poem the first time, this isn't the first time I've read his Death of Arthur poem, I did not know that it was, he wanted it to be, or that he considered it part of Middle Earth. Like, this is part of Lord of the Rings, you know, the world of Lord of the Rings. And it's a really beautiful poem. And he talks about, it's told from the standpoint of, another monk asking Brendan, St. Brendan, to tell him about what he saw on his journey, like before he dies, basically. And the three things that, he saw, the things I have seen, the many things have long now faded far. Only three come clear now back to me, a cloud, a tree, a star. So what do those mean in the context of this poem? Because he's pulling from the St. Brendan story, but it's not quite the same thing as the Brendan story.
Yeah. So these are repeating motifs throughout his work.
Mm-hmm.
The cloud is revealed to be a mountain, kind of towering, impossibly tall mountain crowned with fire. This is very much the image of the holy mountain in the Silmarillion, the Tanaquetum, which is the dwelling place of the angelic powers on earth. The tree repeats in the Lord of the Rings and in the Silmarillion. So you have the white tree,
right,
Telperion, the silver in Valinor, one of the two trees that provide light to the world. You have the white tree of Gondor, the seedling of that tree, which is a symbol of kingship. Here it's a symbol of kind of otherworldly blessing. It's where the leaves are described as actually like swan-white birds,
yeah,
which fly away when they approach. So here it's more a symbol of kind of the divine, the spiritual. And the star is the symbol of hope that repeats throughout his work. The star of Eärendil in the Silmarillion, the messenger, becomes a star carrying the jewel, the Silmaril, with him. So he becomes the evening star, the herald to men. And this is another motif that he draws actually from the Old English poem, the Eärendil poem, which describes the John the Baptist as like the coming of the star, the angel sent above.
Cool.
Middle Earth.
Yeah, that's really cool. And this is all, so this poem, it's considered to be, Tolkien didn't publish this in his lifetime, and it's found
was published in his lifetime.
Oh, it was? Oh, okay.
In a modified form, so, but yeah, you were going to introduce where it's found.
Yes, yeah, I thought I remembered reading that, maybe, I think Christopher Tolkien said something about how it was very secret to Tolkien. I read that as it was not published in his lifetime. So it's all found in this is we'll get to Charlemagne and all that stuff.
Yeah.
These are things that I'm not super familiar with, like the Notion Club paper. So this is found in his Notion Club papers. Tell us about that and what else he was doing with that, with those writings.
Yeah, so the Notion Club papers, it's a really fun unfinished novel that Tolkien started. So back in 1936, he made this deal with C.S. Lewis that Lewis would write a space story, Tolkien would write a time travel story.
Right.
And this is, you know, the outcome of this is pretty well known. Lewis wrote the space trilogy of the silent planet, Perelandra, that hideous strength. Tolkien began work on a novel called The Lost Road, but didn't really make it very far in before abandoning the project. But in 1945, he came back to this idea with a new book, which he originally titled Out of the Talkative Planet, as a reference to Lewis, and settled on the name The Notion Club Papers. The Notion Club is a very almost thinly veiled reference to the Inklings, to the group
that right.
Lewis and Tolkien would be discussing. Notion, Inkling are synonyms.
Yeah.
So it's... The conceit of the novel is that in 2012, someone discovers these papers of a group of academics and creative types who are meeting in the 1980s, and each of the members correspond to some facets of the personalities of each of the Inklings group. But they all meet to discuss this dream that one of the characters has been having of a giant wave overwhelming a green country, a green island, which turns out to be a version of the Atlantis Numenor story that Tolkien would later incorporate to the Silmarillion. And as part of this, one of the characters has written a poem inspired by the imagery from this dream about the voyage of St. Brandon. And the poem is written up first in this novel as part of the text. It was later then published in 1955 in the English literary magazine Time and Tide in the December issue of that year. So a modified version of the poem was actually published.
Oh, I see. Okay.
In Tolkien's lifetime, but it is very difficult to come by. You basically, nowadays you can read it in the History of Middle-earth series with the rest of the Notion Club papers. But before that was published, it was actually very difficult to find.
So yeah.
Not a lot of people have heard of it.
Right. Well, this, the one you sent me was from the Inglewood Review of Books. And it's just right on there. And I'll put a link in the show notes too. It's The Death of St. Brendan by, you know, Tolkien. So yeah, thank you. So yeah, his Notion Club papers, he was, why did he not finish the time travel story? Do you know?
I think because he was unsatisfied with the idea of bringing the current day back into this past. That eventually becomes the Silmarillion. So
right.
A lot of these ideas, a lot of the, even the wording that he's working with, especially in this poem, make it almost word for word into the Silmarillion.
Right. Okay.
The idea of the straight road, the path, the mystical path that only the elves and certain men can journey to see the paradise beyond the world. That appears in this poem, that appears in the Notion Club papers, but really, I think it was just this gradual working out that he really wanted, the story he really wanted to tell was focused on the elder days, on the ancient times. This framing device was a little bit impeding that.
I think that's was probably a good call. I mean, as much as I would have loved that, you know, a fleshed out story like that, I think it just wouldn't have fit, you know. It just wouldn't have fit very well unless it was completely separated from the Middle Earth, you know. But Tolkien just wasn't capable of writing anything else, you know. Like it all had to be connected, and if he couldn't connect it together, then he would scrap it.
He's a great synthesizer in that way. That he brings everything into kind of one narrative, one story.
But, yeah. Know. Well, then he's a genius, and he pulls from all these different strands of mythology, and like you said, he can synthesize them into something extremely coherent and metaphysically solid, you know. And you know, he's got like basically the Odin trope of a wandering sort of old man in a broad rimmed hat, and you know, as Gandalf, and then he changes that into, you know, when he transfigures into Gandalf the White, you know, and you know, he's got Beowulf in there and all these, just all this Norse and Greek mythology kind of baked into it. And it's just amazing. That's just me kind of, you know, going off a little bit. So with this idea of the West and this, you know, this land out in the West, there's Gandalf kind of, he references it once, I believe, maybe twice, when he, I think he's talking to Merry or Pippin, about, you know, I think with Merry, maybe this is the movie, maybe I'm getting confused with the movies, but he, when Merry or Pippin asks him, is this the end? And then he says, no, it's not the end, you know, and then he talks about, you know, what the, off to the West, you know, with I don't have the quote, it's a beautiful quote, but, like the green hills and the curtain rolls back and it's a swift sunrise. And so,
yeah, actually, I have the quote from the end of the book.
Okay, yeah.
In my...
I think I'm remembering the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it reads that it seemed to him, Frodo, The gray rain curtain turned all to silver glass and was rolled back, and he beheld white shores and beyond them a far green country under a swift sunrise.
That's what it is. Yep.
So in the movie, that line is given to Gandalf to kind of include it in. Otherwise, you don't have the poetry of the language. You just have the image.
Yep. No, it's... And I think how they handled that in the movie, that's why, I mean, it fits so well. That's why I'm mistaking it for the book, you know, it's, because I love that scene so much. And I'm not a Jackson hater. I think there's some flaws that I think are understandable, you know, especially with like Faramir and stuff. But I think overall he did really well with the original trilogy. So with this idea of the West, I mean, this is where Frodo ends up going to, correct? He goes for healing, because he, like, basically, why don't you explain, why does Frodo need to go to the West?
So, in the story, in the Lord of the Rings, the West is a physical location. It is a place that can be sailed to by people who have the craft, by the elves. And it's a land that is made holy by the deathless, by the angels and these immortal beings living there. And this is made explicit in the Silmarillion.
Mm-hmm.
Frodo's healing is necessary because, in some sense, he is so changed and scarred by his ordeal that it's beyond the natural capacity of this world to heal.
Yeah.
And he's being taken out of the natural into the supernatural to find this final redemption.
Yeah.
In the poems and the Imram of the Irish monks, I think the West has this eschatological dimension.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Rome for a semester, which is one of the great things about Christendom College, they have a study abroad semester you can opt into.
Awesome.
We went to, I think it was the Church of St. Apollinarius in the Basilica of St. Apollinarius in Rome, and there's a mosaic of the Second Coming where Christ is descending on this kind of sunset clouds.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is Christ is born in the east. He's born in Jerusalem, or in Bethlehem in the east. He's coming again in the west because he is this solar figure in the, you know, one of the Old Testament prophetic names for Christ is the Son of Justice.
Right.
So the sunset, the West, then takes on this eschatological dimension where paradise is located in the West because the West is associated with Christ's second coming.
Mm, yeah.
That we're all, in a certain sense, journeying West towards the end of time.
Mm-hmm. And does this concept have anything to do with, like, I mean, it probably does, but how, like, with the idea of Western civilization, you know, with all this talk about, you know, Western civilization, and I'm not saying this is wrong, but, like, it's a marriage of Athens and Jerusalem, right?
Right.
Does this have anything to do with that, or is it just kind of like a, just two, they're just both named West, before, like Adam West.
Yeah, you know? Before the 20th century, really. You do have references to Western civilization, this idea of Western civilization, but it's very rare.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of the West is really revived after the First World War in Europe as this means of unifying the peoples of Europe who just experienced this traumatic war, this fratricidal war, right? This war between brothers.
Yeah.
Unifying them in this idea of a Christian civilization. And the idea of the West, very much tied to the Crusades, very much tied to the medieval conception of Europe, meaning mostly Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Parts of Eastern Europe. Poland, you know, is very much part of the West in this conception. It's this idea of a unity that is brought about through means beyond simply cultural affinity or blood affinity. It's a unity that has a supernatural origin.
Yeah.
And so you really can't divorce this idea of Western civilization, especially since it was revived in the 20th century under an explicitly Christian model.
Yeah, the reason I ask is when I first read your essay, I thought that's what it was about, right? It was like this concept of Western civilization in Tolkien's story, and that's not quite what it was, right? It's this concept of what you're saying, like the eschatological West, you know, and paradise being in the West.
That's what I was going to write about when I started the essay.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of this research, this digging into the real origins of this idea of the West.
Yeah, I don't know. I used to be more like, yeah, Western civilization. I mean, I still am, obviously. I like Western civilization, you know. But I don't know. When you learn about like Eastern Christianity and stuff, that idea it's harder to, I don't know. It's just not as like coherent. You know what I mean?
It's really a global, like it is a universal institution.
Right.
And a universal, in a certain sense, a universal religious culture that embraces all these other modes of liturgy and philosophy and theology.
Right. Well, then you have the conservative talking heads too, who kind of, some of them, not all of them, some of them kind of tend to downplay the Catholic, you know, sort of Catholicity to the West. That bugs me, you know, it's.
Yeah.
They kind of downplay it, and they're like, oh, they mention, like, you know, Christianity, or, you know, it's like a pillar. It's like a pillar of it, of the West. Like, no, I'm like, Christianity is the West, man. Like,
right.
Like, you wouldn't have any of this stuff without Catholicism, basically.
Yeah.
So
the ancient Greeks, and they talk about the West and about Europe as the barbarians, as
exactly.
The land over there that has nothing to do with us.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway.
And, yeah, this unity really only comes about through a supernatural and supranational church.
Right. Yeah, it's just funny because, like, you have all these different conceptions of the West that are out there, and it's like it really just comes down to the Catholic Church, you know what I mean? And, you know, pulling in all of all this wisdom from the Greeks and Romans and all, you know, the mythology and stuff, like incorporating it and synthesizing it, not in like a syncretistic way, but like using the motifs and symbols and like basically rescuing them from, you know, either obscurity or being misused. Kind of moving to your another main part of your well, I guess so. Here, I'll just read your thesis for your essay. So, by engaging with a close reading of The Lord of the Rings and some of Tolkien's own reflections on his work throughout his letters, this paper will consider the parallels between Tolkien's restored kingdom and the Carolingian Holy Roman Empire, its relation to the West as a source of spiritual renewal, and his defense against the Nazi usurpation of Western mythology. So, the Nazis were, you know, they like kind of what I was saying, they would misuse mythological symbolism, right, and this concept of the West. They totally perverted it and misused it, and Tolkien was not a fan of that.
One comparison I think Tolkien would probably appreciate is you can almost view Tolkien's use of the West and of the history and mythology of Christendom as cultivating a garden, cultivating these ideas until they blossom into his stories, versus the National Socialists, the Nazi usage of these things is more like strip mining them.
Yeah.
Digging out what little nuggets of ideology they can pull from these things and discarding everything else.
Right. Well, and then, so much of what the Nazis did was completely ahistorical, too. And I think there was so Lovecraft, H.P. Lovecraft was a... He was kind of a Hitler fanboy for a little while. I think he fell out of favor with them. I like Lovecraft. I think he's a very misunderstood figure. I think he's kind of a if you knew him in real life, you'd be like, oh, he's a sad dude. You know, you know what I mean? You would feel bad for him. Obviously, I don't endorse everything he believed. I endorse very little of what he believed, but I just can't help but like. He's just kind of endearing, but he realized even that the Nazis' use of like Aryan, like their scientific, you know, quote unquote, use of like the Aryan race and all that stuff that didn't have any water under it. You know, it was just all bunk. Right. And he realized that, and he's like, oh, oh, okay. You know? Yeah. So even, yeah, so like the Nazis were all just...
There's a kind of loss of memory about the context, the historical context of the 1930s.
Oh, yeah.
The surprising thing isn't that Lovecraft was maybe enticed by some of the Nazi propaganda. The surprising thing is that Tolkien wasn't.
Yep.
That he saw,
through it. Yeah.
In the very beginning, because for a while in the very early 30s, you know, 1933, 1934, Hitler is this figure of progress. He's this figure of the future that even European figures like Churchill, the later leaders of the Western Allies, almost admire.
Yeah.
But Tolkien was having none of that from the very beginning. He saw through,
right.
He saw through the facade.
Right. So how did he do that? So how are the Nazis using these mythological themes? And then Tolkien accused them basically of perverting and poisoning Norse mythology, like, forever, you know, like, because of how they used it. So how did Tolkien use these motifs, and how did the Nazis use them?
So for Tolkien, he's very deeply seeped into the, he's deeply almost nourished by these myths, by this folklore, to the point where he is extremely fluent, extremely conversant with the history. There are so many times reading The Lord of the Rings, once you've actually started to dig into these texts, especially the Anglo-Saxon ones, where you're like, oh, this is almost a direct parallel to this.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Theoden is a direct parallel to certain Anglo-Saxon things about Alfred. So he knew what was true about them. He knew the history. The Nazis, on the other hand, you have this kind of, you even have this infighting over whether or not Charlemagne counts as a great German historical figure, with the various leadership split on whether to depict him as an ancient hero or a monster because of this incoherent approach to history and mythology,
mm-hmm.
where they simply take what has the appearance of power, what has the appearance of resonance, and disregard the deeper truths behind it.
Right.
Whereas Tolkien is all about revealing those deeper truths, digging into them, incorporating them into his own work.
Yeah, the Nazis were all... I mean, a lot of it was justifying their ideas, you know, and using these... Basically, like, they're kind of working at it from... Like, Tolkien's working at it from the myths themselves, like, he being embedded in them, and... kind of like trying to, yeah, like you said, trying to bring the truth out of them. And the Nazis were, I mean, basically, like you said it very well, strip mining them. They're coming at them from their preconceived notions of, you know, their ideas and what's true, and then just taking what they want and, you know, and just bastardizing it and making it work for their own ideology. Whereas Tolkien was kind of embedded in them, you know, and he was letting the myths basically speak for themselves, you know, and he's taking them as they were, whereas the Nazis were butchering them.
An example of how his work is in opposition to this is the heroes of the Lord of the Rings are the hobbits, right? They're the ordinary people. They're the ordinary rustic English people that he grew up with, that he was when he was a child. And they're the almost exact opposite of this Hegelian idea of the great man of history.
Mm-hmm.
They're not powerful warlords. They're not conquerors. They're not extremely intelligent builders of culture or civilization. They are just the ordinary people who stick by what's right through this time of crisis. And you do have your place for your great men. Aragorn is a great man. He's a powerful and charismatic figure of authority.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not the focus of the story.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's very much an anti-Nazi idea. You know, like it's the humble. The humble, like they give the ring to Frodo because Sauron wouldn't expect it, basically, because Sauron is proud and he would not expect something like as crazy as that, you know, to be attempted. And yeah, that doesn't really fit in with Nazi ideology. That is like the exact opposite. So yeah, Tolkien could see through their nonsense. And that was a really interesting piece that you because there's a famous letter where Tolkien, I think it's his, one of the books is of his is being translated into German or something like that, and he wrote a letter to, or he was responding, he wrote a letter responding to the publisher, because they asked him, I think, if he was of Jewish descent or something like that.
That was legally necessary at the time.
Yeah.
They mandated that books not be published by authors of Jewish descent.
Right, so, right. And Tolkien basically told them off.
Yeah. It's like, I'm not having anything to do with this.
Right. I'm sad. I'm not a proud member of that great race of people or whatever he said. You know, it's like, right. Yeah. So yes, Tolkien, not a Nazi. Yeah.
And also, a lot of the people who are focused on this idea of arriving the Christian West also end up becoming anti-Nazi, anti the ideological appropriation of the West by this very secular, very revolutionary force.
Right.
Yeah, the Abendland movement, the various writers for that would contribute to writing denunciations of Nazi texts, von Hildebrand's especially.
Oh, yeah. I mean, his book, My Battle Against Hitler, you know, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Tolkien just fits very neatly into that grouping, even though most of these people... It's very unlikely that he met them or was very fluent in their works, but he had that same foundational Catholic heritage that he drew on.
So, yeah, they're competing ideologies completely, like fundamentally opposed to each other. And I think you read this book too, The Church of Spies by Mark Reibling.
Yes, that actually did play a role in my...
Yeah, great. That's such a cool book. In there, he said that Hitler knew that Catholicism was fundamentally opposed to Nazi ideology because both systems, both the religion of Catholicism and the ideology of Nazism demand the total person, demand the whole man. You know, you had to be fully committed. You couldn't do any half measures on either one. You know, so you're either a good Catholic or you're a Nazi, you know, and there are plenty of Nazi Catholic Nazis, you know, but they should not have been, you know what I mean?
Right. It's a living contradiction.
Right. Right. So
and this idea of faith of God demanding the whole person shows up throughout the works of Tolkien as well. The whole journey of Frodo is in some sense a journey of a surrender of his whole person to this task of overcoming evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so in your, you also mentioned that this idea of the West is a source of spiritual renewal and of like restoration. And we've been talking about restoring the West with figures like Tolkien and Hildebrand. So how is this idea of the West that Tolkien understood it, a source of spiritual renewal? What were they trying to do? Well, you know, what was Tolkien? Right. You know, how was he using the concept as a source of spiritual renewal?
Yeah. So it's not a very controversial opinion that by the beginning of the 20th century, faith was kind of dying off in Europe.
Yeah.
The church was becoming less and less a facet of public life.
Mm-hmm.
With World War One ending, you see the end of these last, like, Catholic monarchies, these specifically Catholic-oriented governments in Europe. Secularism seems to be reigning supreme. And with secularism comes this idea of division, because the state, when the state becomes a source of unity, that doesn't compute to having multiple states being multiple centers of unity. You kind of only have to have one.
Right? Right.
You can only have one secular organization at a time be the focal point for the people, as opposed to this universal church, which can be the focal point of unity throughout Christendom.
Mm-hmm.
And so the class of people that Tolkien belongs to, these writers, these Western-oriented writers, are looking to this time before secularism, this time before the division of the church and state, to look for the unity that will bring people back together in the aftermath of catastrophes like the First World War. And that involves renewing spiritual practices, because a church that isn't practiced isn't lived, it's dead.
Right? Yeah, right.
It can't be a source of anything if you're not praying with the church, if you're not going to Mass with the church, if you're not living out this religion in your life. And so the West and the church kind of become this symbiotic source where culture is renewed by looking back at the Western heritage, by looking back at the heritage of the Middle Ages, at the heritage of the Gothic cathedrals, of the stories of the literature of the Middle Ages, Dante, all of these various things. And then the church, on the other hand, is this fountain of spiritual renewal, of bringing back grace into people's lives so that this culture can actually bear fruit. And this is an idea that's basically as old as the Middle Ages themselves. This Charlemagne starts out not as an emperor, but he starts out actually as reviving the Roman Empire. By the time he reaches the kind of his old age, he's crowned as Roman Emperor by Pope Leo III in Rome. And this idea is seen as a renovation, as a restoration of the idea of the unity of the empire in the West. And this restoration involves him setting the churches in his realm in order, setting the church in Rome in order, so that the people can be spiritually nourished, because there's a tumultuous situation in Rome where the people are trying to kind of kick out this pope that they don't like.
Right.
This rival, I guess he's elected from a rival family. The politics before the 800s in the church, sometimes we think today it's pretty bad, and it is, but like you read early church history and it can get really crazy as well. But essentially, he's a figure of restoration, of bringing back unity and order to a divided land. And at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, Europe is once again this divided land that's awaiting someone to bring back this unifying order, or someone's, because it really was a group project.
Yeah.
Because it culminates in the post-World War II world as the original European Union project. And I don't think we have time to get to that whole history of what happened there, but the European Union was originally this explicitly Catholic project.
Well, even the stars, like in the circle,
yeah.
Wasn't that a Marian thing? The blue flag with the 12 stars. Yeah. Yeah. I know, what's that guy's name? Political theorist, Adrian Vermeule, on Twitter. I think he had that as his like logo for a while. He followed me for a little bit. That was fun. Then he didn't anymore. And I'm like, okay, whatever. So this actually really kind of dovetails with the other piece in your essay, with the restoration of the West, the unification of divided land. You mentioned, King Arthur, who also did that, and Tolkien wanted to bring him into the story. But
And in the Middle Ages, Arthur is almost seen as a precursor to Charlemagne.
Yeah,
He goes to Rome. In a lot of the legends, he goes to Rome to be crowned as emperor, only to not make it all the way there because Mordred has messed stuff up back home. But his story is often conflated with the story of Charlemagne to make him seem like a precursor to the title.
Awesome. That's cool. And they're both one of the nine worthies, right? Charlemagne and King Arthur. Right. Yeah. And the nine worthies were these nine figures in that medieval Christians looked to. They weren't saints necessarily, but they were like great men. You had like three pagans.
Heroes.
Yeah. Three pagan heroes, three Jewish heroes, and three Christian heroes. And it was King Arthur, Charlemagne. See if I can do this. He's the crusader who liberated Jerusalem in the first crusade. What was it? I can't remember his name.
Yeah, Godfrey.
Godfrey. Yeah, thank you. Godfrey de Bouillon.
Yeah.
And then you have Judas Maccabeus, King David, and I always forget the third one of every single one of these guys. I can't remember.
Yeah.
you had Hector, and for the pagans, you had Hector and Julius Caesar and
Alexander.
And Alexander the Great. Yeah, yep, yep. I want to do an episode on that sometime. But Aragorn, you parallel Aragorn with Charlemagne. And I think if people have been paying attention, we can see how that happens. But why don't you go ahead and explain how is Aragorn a parallel to Charlemagne?
Yeah, so they both start out in this very war-torn world, this world of division and barbarism, faced by threats on all sides, but especially threats to the east. So Mordor is in the east. Charlemagne is constantly facing the attacks from the pagan Saxons in the east of Israel. They come together, assembling these groups of heroes. Charlemagne has his paladins. Mm-hmm. Aragorn first brings the Fellowship and then the Grey Company together to bring back order to the land and to restore a crown, a kingdom, an empire that has long since been without a king, it's been a vacant position. So you do have in Charlemagne's time the emperors claiming to be Roman emperors in the east, the Byzantine emperors, which we can say they're the Eastern Roman emperors. They do have that tradition, the same with Constantine. But in the west, there was this lack of leadership on that scale. So it would be fair to say that for hundreds of years before Charlemagne's time, the west was crownless. This group of peoples from various cultures who should have been together, who should have been brought together in this pursuit of the common good, had no one to unify them, no one person to attach to, basically, right, as a leader. And Charlemagne comes, he spends most of his life fighting to bring this unity and this order to his lands. People from as far away as Ireland and Spain, you know, various parts of Spain, and in the east, you know, Germans and various other pagan tribes come to him and acknowledge his kingship. And then he receives his kingship. He receives the ultimate form, the symbol of his rule, the crown, from the church, from the Pope. This proof that he's not claiming power for himself, that he's receiving it as a gift from divine authority. And Aragorn, when he reaches the climax of the story, when he's after Sauron is defeated and everything is put back in order, he comes to the city and he doesn't crown himself. He doesn't take the title for himself. It's bestowed upon him by this emissary of the divine power, by Gandalf, who's an angelic figure himself. And with his staff and with his kind of his modus of going around and guiding the peoples of Middle-earth towards the action that they have to take, he's very much a pastor. He's very much the shepherd figure that the Pope is supposed to be for Christendom. And so the parallels between Charlemagne's coronation and Aragorn's coronation extend to this idea of kingship as received from God. This idea of political authority. I mean, there's various ways in which political authority can be appointed. For most of the Middle Ages, the Holy Roman Emperors were elected. It wasn't a hereditary position. But no matter who appoints you, whether it's the people, and in Charlemagne's case, you actually do have the people of Rome who declare that they want him to be their emperor. In either case, whether it's the people or whether it's by birth that you're chosen, it's God who gives you rule. It's God who gives you authority.
It's always nice when the people are behind it.
Right. You know? And this older vision, too, like, it's very clear that you can't simply take power without involving the people.
Right.
Faramir actually asks the people of the city, will you accept this man as your king? Will you accept his claims? Because Aragorn does have a lawful claim through the laws of Gondor. But he's not going to simply walk in and say, I'm in charge now.
Right, yeah.
He's going to seek approval both from the people who he's ruling, but also from the higher power, which really is the self, the image, that it's the earthly role of Christian kings is an icon of God's rule over the universe.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to make present in a visual way that idea to the people.
Well, yeah, and when Christ is talking to Pontius Pilate, basically Christ said, you have the authority to do this because my Father has given you that authority, basically. There's always a question of like overthrowing a dictator, right? But most of the time, the people who are in charge have that authority from God. Then you have someone like Hitler when you can, or Stalin or whatever, where you can reasonably say, okay, this guy, I think St. Thomas talked about this too. You can overthrow a tyrant if they're, if they're truly a tyrant, then you can overthrow them.
In a certain sense, the tyrant is at war with his own subjects. He's at war with the people he's ruling over.
It's fundamentally destructive.
The true ruler, the Christian ruler, whether he's a king or a president, it doesn't. The title isn't what's important. What's really important is that he's ruling for the sake of peace.
Right.
That he's establishing justice and peace between men and between all men, his subjects between each other and between himself and his subjects, or between the citizens and themselves. So this idea of peace is paramount to both the Carolingian conception of authority as drawn from the works of St. Augustine and to Tolkien's conception of authority.
Yeah. And that's not always easy for Christians, especially now, if you're practicing your faith and you consider yourself conservative, which I do. It's hard, to be obedient to bad leaders. Obviously, we don't have to listen to things if they're evil, right? That's never, mm-hmm. never what we need to do. But, with the current, political stuff going on right now, it can be hard. It can be hard to hear that. It's always hard to be reminded St. Paul said to basically listen to what the emperor tells you to do, even though the emperor's a pagan, unless they're telling you to do something really sinful, like, pinch of incense on the altar of Zeus. And then, no, don't do that. But like, you gotta be subject to him, you gotta be a good citizen. And so there are obviously limits, but
Tolkien has this image. He talks in one of his letters about how the figure of Denethor, the steward of Gondor, who's really kind of in place of a king while there is no king there. He talks about how he's concerned with the merely political aspects of his rule, that like he's obsessed with the political. And Denethor isn't a figure in the books that is evil.
Right.
Not until he's overwhelmed by this kind of despair. But he's not ruling the way that Tolkien believes and other Catholic philosophers of politics believe that a Christian ruler should really model oneself on. He's not focusing on the good. He's focusing on these purely political ideas of enmity and control.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like we can simply reject the Denethors in our lives. While the stewards still stand in the place of the kings, while these governments are still providing some sense of the common good for the people, we kind of have to work around them and work within them until we can restore this truer conception of peace and freedom and authority.
Yeah, it's another point where Jackson, I think, got Denethor. He got Denethor wrong. I think he got like that whole. He got Boromir, I think, pretty okay. But like Faramir and Denethor, I think he kind of misunderstood what both those characters were.
Right.
Where Denethor was really this kind of sinister. I mean, the whole meme of him eating a tomato. The juice is everywhere. Just really gross. Really intense.
I don't think Tolkien. So he's often quoted with his quote of. My political opinions lean towards anarchy,
right?
Which is one of his more hyperbolic points. But he did in some sense see, like, the governments that we exist under today aren't ideal. In fact, they're pretty far from the ideal.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty far from good government. But we still have to work with them. We still have to live with them. But that doesn't mean we have to submit to this. We don't have to take this purely realist approach to politics. We can still hold to working towards and developing a return to these older forms, these more traditional forms of rule and these more godlike, Christ-like approaches to political authority.
Yeah. So now we have the concept of the West. We have this understanding of Aragorn as Charlemagne. And you mentioned that this is the West concept is eschatological in many ways. You mentioned something in your essay, and this all kind of ties together. You mentioned the last world emperor in your essay. And now that's something I've heard before, and I know a little bit about it, but why don't you explain how Aragorn kind of embodies it, what the myth is, you know, and how Aragorn kind of embodies it.
Yeah. So the last world emperor is a pretty common myth that shows up in Christian medieval literature and folk stories and things, where it has its origins in this idea of the Roman Empire as kind of the catacomb, the holding back of the Antichrist, where as long as this world empire exists, this claim to universal political authority, the Antichrist won't be able to come and disrupt it until after that time is completed. That time, you know, that this figure of the last world emperor has reigned. And it's found in the 9th century in the works of this monk Adso, who was writing a commentary on the end times. It's found throughout the Middle Ages. And this idea develops, there's various so-called prophecies. It's really hard to trace back the history of these to see if they're authentic or not.
You're right.
Because it gets tied into a lot of various political machinations and various things of claims of European rulers. But essentially, this idea develops that he'll be this figure who arises out of poverty, who arises out of the outcasts and fringes of society in a time of great upheaval and crisis to come back and fulfill this prophecy of a new monarch who brings in a new age of peace before the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea of the age of peace is also accompanied by this idea of an angelic pope or an angelic pastor who is going to restore the church. And Aragorn really fits in with that, in that, like, he does come out of nowhere. He comes out of the wild. He comes out of this forgotten people to claim a long vacant throne, and ushers in not the end of the world, but the end of the third age, the kind of end of a world.
Right.
A new age of men. And Tolkien is really here taking those elements out of this Christian myth and recasting them in a new light for a new audience, for an audience where this idea of the emperor is maybe a bit foreign, because especially after the dissolution of the Holy Roman Empire after the Napoleonic Wars, and then with the end of the last claimants to that title in Austria in the 1920s, this idea has kind of become foreign to most Catholics, especially in Tolkien's day.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something that he probably would have been aware of, as he definitely would have been aware of, and it's something that he recasts into his story in more comprehensible terms of kingship. Of Aragorn's universal kingship. At one point in the books, towards the end, he's even called the King of the West.
Right, yes, yeah.
But
yeah.
His title is more universal than simply Gondor and Arnor.
Right. Well, I think there's a legend about King Arthur, too, returning one day. There's this, like, the return of this king, you know, like, return of the king. Like, Arthur will return and save England in her time of need, you know, in her final hour, King Arthur will return. And, I mean, that's really cool.
even in political, non-mythological history, you have the Return of the Stuarts. You have the Bonnie Prince Charlies and this figures of these Scottish and English kings who are sent into exile and have to come back. Legitimism as a political movement is a really interesting phenomenon because it's often tied to these Catholic dynasties who are very often driven into exile. You have the Bourbons in France, you have the Carlists in Spain. Yeah.
Cool. I think you're kind of had some audio issues there, but I we got most of that, I think. Okay. Yeah, you're kind of lagging a little bit, but I think that's okay. Yeah. So that's, I don't know what else to say. It's a pretty cool topic. It just shows that Tolkien is incorporating a lot of these elements. One thing that I think these stories do is they can, like what Tolkien, like he said he's repackaging this stuff for a modern audience. And people who have no idea, you know, like who, you know, what the West is, you know, who St. Brendan was, you know, who Charlotte, you know, no idea. They get a taste of it with Tolkien. They get these, like the last world emperor, all those like mythological things. They get a taste of that with Tolkien that they would not normally have ever heard of before. And it's kind of a way, like C.S. Lewis says, like smuggling past the watchful dragons, like, you know, getting these ideas in people's subconscious and in their imaginations, like helping their imaginations to incorporate these things is really beneficial, you know, because then if they are interested, they go back to the history and they go, oh yeah, this is just like Aragorn, you know, it's, you know, so it's like, it's priming their imagination for Christ, basically. Like that's what Tolkien does. Cause that's a good way to,
exactly right.
Yeah. It's like conceptualizing Christ as a benevolent king. At some level, it's like all kind of just words, you know, you hear it a lot, or like he's the good shepherd, you know, it all loses its kind of meaning. And then you read Lord of the Rings and it kind of re-enchants that all that language, you know, and you can actually see it in real time, so to speak, like an example of it. And that's what C.S. Lewis did too. You know, he wanted to re-enchant the Gospels for people. And so I think that's the one of the most powerful things about these stories, is that they can package these ideas in a form that you don't suspect. And not that like it's being really sneaky or anything. It's just most people, like today, me, I didn't grow up knowing anything about Charlemagne or, you know, or Catholic kings, or, you know, I knew the Family Guy version of it, you know, which was to mock it and belittle it. But so it's like someone like me who's kind of coming at it from Lord of the Rings, like reading Lord of the Rings and then like learning all about all this stuff. It does bring with it this element of enchantment when you go back and read and learn about King Arthur and Charlemagne. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think this idea of re-enchantment is very much at the forefront of Tolkien's work. Are you getting a echo on your end?
No, but you are a little delayed.
Okay.
No echo, though.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure it wasn't. Yeah, the audio wasn't cutting out on you. It's very much the re-enchantment is very much his goal. It's very much part of his mission to bring these concepts into the modern, into their attention, and really, prime the imagination is exactly what he's doing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap it up? I know it's getting late for you, and I appreciate you chatting with me. I know you're like an hour ahead of me. So, and this is the feast of St. Michael today. So,
a great day to have this discussion.
Yeah, yeah. So I didn't do a whole lot special today, but we did recite the St. Michael prayer with the kids and. Yeah, I mean, it's I pray to St. Mike all the time. So he's a cool guy, you know. he's a friend worth having.
I guess to wrap it up, I would recommend reading the poem that I guess will be in the show notes. Mm-hmm. The link. Every time I go through The Lord of the Rings and Tolkien's various other writings, there's something new, something deeper to be found. So reread The Lord of the Rings. Like, you can never read it too many times.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That would be my message to your audience.
Awesome. And then I have one, and I actually need to reread it too. It's been a while, but so whenever I talk about Tolkien, I'm just like, oh yeah, Numenor. Okay, you know, like I've it's been a little while since I've read it, so it's like, I just got to pretend I know what I'm talking about for at least a little bit. But that's why I have guests on who know way more than me about it. But I have one more question for you, and you probably know what it is. I ask this of all the new guests who come on the show. And the show is called I Might Believe in Fairies. And it's I might because I am agnostic about the existence of fairies as creatures. But I want to know if you, Matthew, if you believe in fairies.
So I am also agnostic on the question of the existence of fairies as physical or spiritual creatures. But I think they're a very, very important part of our imagination, of our way of telling stories as humans, where we have to cast certain elements of the soul, whether they're the nobler elements like wolves, or the more dangerous elements as in some traditional fairy tales, into these other figures to act as a kind of mirror, as Tolkien writes about non-fairy figures. But I do think that there is not really a theological barrier to the existence of fairies, from what I can tell. It's just that they're not really in evidence to me this time. Maybe they'll reveal themselves to me after this episode.
I hope they don't. Right. I never want to meet any spiritual creature ever. Like, never. But yeah, that's pretty much me too. I think they're important for imaginative purposes. I think the idea of fairyland is important for imaginative purposes. But as creatures, like, there are theological ways to, you know, if they did exist, to fit them in very, you know, not, I don't want to say easily, but they could be fit into, you know, a Christian theological framework, and they might not even be demons. Right. You know, like, they don't have to just be demons.
Yeah, I mean, I take a similar view on the existence of extraterrestrial intelligent life.
Yeah, right.
It could fit in. But, you know, at this point, we don't know it. We don't have... There are some things we just don't know.
Right. We just don't know. And then where can people find your writings, and where can they, you're on social media, so what's your Twitter, or X, now it's called X, whatever, X handle.
I still call it Twitter.
I know, it's so stupid, come on, like, Twitter is a perfect name.
My handle is at mscarince, so S-C-A-R-I-N-C-E, and my writings can be found, I've written primarily on my website, theworldofchristendom.com. But also, I have an essay coming out for New Quality on the history of the administrative state and Catholic government. So, you know, keep an eye out for that. That's coming in supposed to be the summer issue, but I guess it's been the fall issue.
Gotcha. Well, I know you had a very nice Twitter thread once on Gene Wolfe's The Wizard Knight that I would love to see in like a long essay form about how he... Like, he told the Wizard Knight is like basically a medieval type of story, like they call the Mirror of Princes, where like you would basically, right. You would, if you were a royalty, you would read those stories as to help teach you what good leadership and what good authority would be. And I would love a long form essay on that.
Oh yeah, I'm definitely interested in revisiting that topic. I mean, mm-hmm. We didn't really talk at all about Wolf on this episode, but he's also heavily influenced by the St. Brendan's story.
There's even like, but, in Peace, in his novel Peace, St. Brendan actually, like that story shows up in that novel. St. Brendan shows up a number of times, not necessarily as a character, but like the story of St. Brendan shows up a number of times in like different short stories and stuff. Yeah, he very much influenced Gene Wolfe. I guess my final thought would be go read the Golden Legends. Go read all those stories and just like live in them and imbibe them into your imagination. And don't worry about it if it's factual or not. It doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. Like, stop. Like, if that's your first question, it's like you got to just ditch that at the door. Like, like if your mind can't handle miracles, then you shouldn't read the Gospels either, you know? So it's like,
yeah.
So that's pretty much.
This is the imagination. These are the stories that form the imagination of your spiritual forefather.
Yeah.
Of the Catholics of the Middle Ages and earlier and later. And so we really need to be soaking ourselves in that tradition.
Yeah, and people don't talk about the Golden Legends very much. You know, they're just not. And like you can go on Amazon and you can buy them, but they're not cheap, you know, and we need like a good quality, affordable Golden Legends, like maybe a multi-volume set that you'd buy, like, you know, first 10 stories, you know what I mean? It's like, you'd buy the whole set eventually, but it's affordable. It's just not, people just don't know about them, you know, and they were like the most popular stories in the Middle Ages, you know, and they're important, you know, they're about saints, you know, so it's, saints are more than just the prayer cards, you know, they're whole like stories other than just like their, where they were born and like what they're a patron saint of. So,
yeah,
that's my final thought.
Yeah. Well, this was really fun. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I Might Believe in Fairies. Please leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Please follow me on Twitter at Aaron Erber and like me on Facebook. If you're excited to see where the podcast is going and want to offer some support for the project, you can find me on Patreon. Music is by Alexander Nakarada, and podcast art was designed by my wonderful sister-in-law, Linnea Kisby. Until next time, talk to you soon.